This is CliffCentral.com.
This is Gareth Cliff's show. It is a Thursday morning, the 17th of Jan 2019. And I'm not going to preface it any other way, but rather let Canthan Pillay explain what we just played.
We just played putting out the fire with gasoline. This is the burning platform, so it's appropriate.
For anyone who was confused by that, I'm like, well, I just do as I'm asked. Cat People by David Bowie. You think that's the theme song? That's appropriate for the burning platform.
I think it's appropriate for today. Next week, who knows?
Because who knows what happens in this country? Week after week, we're constantly surprised.
This whole continent.
But shout out to Mnangagwa, by the way.
Oh, who's living his best life?
Well, I don't know. You know, is he going to have a country when he gets back? Because you know this whole thing. Because the army has always been in control of what goes on in Zim.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is, when he gets back, are they going to allow him to land? Are they going to divert the aircraft? Well, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, that's why I'm saying he's living his best life, because he isn't around just yet. But he said on Twitter that he has no immediate plans to come back home, though. But, you know.
Except for
he said on Twitter, but his people can't hear it because they haven't got Twitter right now.
I love it. If you don't know
to be traveling the world trying to drum up support for a country that may or may not be. Support
of what? Because right now,
your
country needs you, your people need you. You need to take action. This
traveling the world, Davos, speaking to finances.
I just don't get it at all. So this is the Burning Platform. We do it every single Thursday here on CliffCentral.com. We look at the biggest political stories all across the world, and it was a very, very heated and hot week. We already, Pumi and I just touched on Zimbabwe a few minutes ago on the first hour of the show. And Canthan, what do you think? What's your take on just seeing the shutdown, how it's progressed every single day of this week?
Well,
as he takes a big deep breath.
Just breathe in, breathe out.
Where do I start?
Now go.
Where do I start? You see, the issue in terms of Zim fundamentally is that they've run out of money. And when I say money, they've actually run out of real money, as in U.S. dollars. So I'm not talking about, stuff like, what's these things that we have, Randellas? No. I'm talking about things that actually allow you to buy oil, because that is the important thing. And they've actually run out of money in order to buy fuel. And so because of that, they pushed up the price of oil. The price of fuel, so that it's now effectively, I did the calculation yesterday, it's about 45 Rand a litre.
Mm-hmm.
That's roughly
from 19, hey? From 19 Rand a litre.
Exactly. And so when you're sitting with that scenario, then it's a disaster. But the reason why they got to that place in the first place is, you remember, they went through the scenario where they had Zim dollars, and then they started printing money because they didn't have an independent reserve bank. I'm just sending a shout out to everyone in the ANC who's messing with our reserve bank.
Just know that we don't want to go and buy bread carrying money in a wheelbarrow.
No, but we do want to be then rioting in the streets and going after particular people who are responsible for doing that stuff, right? It's not an incitement to violence, by the way, guys.
What is it?
I just wanted to be out there.
It's subtitles. I'm just looking and watching.
Exactly. It's a prediction.
If it's not inciting violence, what is it?
It's a prediction.
You know, Candace, so I said to Sia earlier when he was talking about the five things that you need to know, that as South Africans, we should be taking lessons. We should be taking lessons from Zimbabwe.
Yes, but we need to be literate first, and that's the first lesson that Zimbabwe has, and we don't have that.
But this is my point, is that even, and that's what I was saying, is you've got skilled Zimbabweans, you've got highly educated Zimbabweans.
And they're all here in our country.
That's my point. And they have all left their country with the education in place, and correctly so, with the skills, with all of that. Their country is currently burning. So we as South Africans, and this doesn't need any kind of bigger.
Except there's vision. No place we can leave and go to. You know, this we can go south.
And so, what individual responsibility, guys? Individual responsibility.
But let's just go back to Zim for a second. You see, the issue fundamentally is that they ran out of money, and the reason why they ran out of money is because they introduced the U.S. dollar for a while, and that was going fine, and then Mugabe decided, well, we actually need money that we haven't got and we need to be able to spend it. So they introduced this thing called bond notes, which are technically equivalent to the U.S. dollar, but in practice they're not because it's stuff that's just being printed by the government. And so you ended up with a situation where these bond notes were not worth real money, so people began hoarding real money. So you then have truck drivers who are traveling, let's say, from Botswana up to Dar es Salaam, and they're driving through Zim on route. So they come along with their real money to buy fuel. They give the real money to Zimbabweans.
Ooh, and they think jackpot.
And the Zimbabweans take the real money and give them the bond notes, and then they fill up their tanks with bond notes. But what they are paying for the bond notes is less than the actual face value of the bond notes. So, you know, they're getting a bonus, the locals are getting a bonus, and inflation just goes through the roof.
It was a long time coming, and though to look at what the situation is like today and how it all transpired, it really is unfortunate that it had to get to this point.
Well, it was a combination of circumstances. Really, what should have happened is at the time that they switched across to using the U.S. dollar, they should have switched to using the South African rand. Because the rand, you know, guys, you know, forgetting what I said earlier, you know, the rand,
South Africa.
The rand in global sense is
it's
insignificant.
Value.
No, in the global sense, it's insignificant. But in the SADC sense, you know, the rand is the 800-pound gorilla. It's the de facto currency of the entire SADC region. So what they should have done, they should have actually switched across to the South African rand instead of using the U.S. dollar. But my understanding at the time was that the reason why they didn't do that is because my good friend Tito Mboweni didn't want to cooperate with Mugabe at the time in order to ensure that there was a money supply that was flowing in that direction, and they switched to the U.S. dollar. Now, the problem that they've got is that a significant chunk of their income comes from Zimbabweans who are working in South Africa and then repatriate their money to Zim. And because they're earning in rands, and Zim is based in dollars, so the money over the Zuma years has gotten progressively less that's been going back home.
You know, the real problem, though, is the ineptitude of... I keep wanting to say
you just wanted to use that word, ineptitude, didn't you?
Ineptitude. Hey, what
word of the day.
Today, going at that with the big ones.
I know inept,
of the
ineptitude.
I keep wanting to say OAU, right? But it's the African Union's real... The problem is that they are ineffective because they are unable to pull these issues to the fore. They are unable to lead the bigger continental conversation, and also.
But
to
we
bring
heard
this
that Nkosazana did such a good job.
Hey, Bona, Kenton. The thing about it, and this is one of the things that pisses me off tremendously here in Joburg with Herman Mashaba.
I'll add that to the long list of
things that piss me off here in Joburg. But Herman Mashaba is at the top of my list because the level of xenophobic incitement, and really the thing about our borders, whether it is Swaziland, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, Botswana, is that they really are a line on the map, because the way that our money and our people move, most of us are sitting at home with aunties that come from Lesotho, you know. So that South African rand moves across that border, like, you know. And for me, the OAU, what did need OAU?
OAU.
I owe you too.
How old am I? 10-year challenge. But one of the things that they are failing to do is they are failing to hold not just the governments responsible. So they let Mugabe run rampant, and by default now Mnangagwa, right? They've let them run rampant and run that Zimbabwe into the
but
ground.
It's
and
an
it's
African
pulling
tradition
all of us
that
down.
We do not criticize our elders.
Hey, boy. Ooh,
and that tradition is
and those traditions
going to stab
maybe
us
need
in
to
the
be.
Back.
And again, you know, the thing for me about the individual responsibility is because the people on the ground, up until that moment where now you're rioting and burning down your own country, it's too late at that point.
But
and
we,
that's
we,
South
we,
Africa's big lesson,
but
I
we
think.
Do that with our trains already.
we're burning everything to the ground, and that's our big lesson. We have to stop. We actually have to be more accountable and more engaged and more involved.
But see, Pumi is going to be preaching to us all morning. You know, we need to be more accountable. We need to be. No, this
what is the alternative? It's easy, I think, for us to sit around and go, "Ish, it could have been better.
We
could have
done that." Voting for stupid people. Can we just do that?
Individual responsibility. So people have got to show up and vote. And you've got to vote. You've got to vote not just for legacy. You've got to vote for policy, which I'm going to allow this to be my. I'm friend dying to hear your views on the DA's billboard.
Friend of mine sent me a message this morning. You know, is there a history of mental illness in your family?
What?
Well, yes, I have a brother who keeps voting ANC. Oh.
You waited the entire week for that one. You were itching.
No, but seriously, while on the brothers with the mental illness of always voting for the ANC. Now that we have had the DA unveil their billboard,
yes.
And we had Musi Maimane addressing the press club in Cape Town, is the DA a viable alternative? Look, now that we've seen their billboard,
if you've missed that,
that says ANC more than DA.
Guys, before we get to the DA, can we talk ANC manifesto?
Oh, last week, what an eventful weekend it was.
So long ago.
Everyone kicked out in there. Gold, black and green. Oh, at Moses Mabhida Stadium.
A full stadium.
My goodness. 80,000 supporters, they said.
Show of force.
filled up the stadium in support of the ANC.
Well, what was interesting was that earlier in the week, they were saying that there was going to be hundreds of thousands at the stadium.
But can the numbers, you know, just... who cares about figures? Because ATM has Zuma millions says, of supporters at the same time.
13,773,000.
Figures.
Yes, but... So, if you look in terms of the manifesto, a lot of the stuff that Cyril was talking about, he was actually correct in the sense that he had actually delivered on... Well, the ANC had delivered on the water, they delivered on electricity and all of that kind of stuff. But it was up until the time that Thabo Mbeki was in power. So over the past 10 years, what have they done? None of that stuff. So and I that's a part even, that people forget.
I can't even think about what it is that the manifesto was about. So I can't even, off the top of my head, think about... five things that the manifesto was about. I, as a communications professional, am thinking this is also them launching their big campaign. I think in 2018 or whatever, they had the, what was it? Their slogan. I can't think of a slogan that's come out of this thing. Mm. I can't think of a rallying cry that's come out of this thing. I can't think of a saleable point.
Well, I thought they're using One South Africa for All as well.
This is what came out of Ramaphosa's address at the manifesto. He said that he calls on all South Africans. I feel like you can copy and paste this to every single manifesto anytime they need to campaign. But he calls on all South Africans to once again put their trust in the ANC as it continues on its path of renewal, unity, and a return to its core values.
Well, let me come in here.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Morning. I did listen to Cyril's speech, which was probably a waste of my time, and it's time I'll never get back.
It's like an hour long.
But here's the main thrust of it. Pumi, you've been talking all morning about individual responsibility. Exactly the opposite is what Cyril was talking about. Cyril was saying, nothing that happens to you in your life is your fault. It's always some external factor. That's number one. Number two, we are here to help you solve all of your problems. You don't have to worry. We'll be your big daddy. We'll look after all the financial constraints and issues, even if we created them. We'll be here to supply you with free whatever you need. Tertiary education. We could promise the world because all we'll do is end up printing money like Zimbabwe did. And there was absolutely nothing around personal responsibility, around how we got to this point. As Canton points out, the last 10 years, what happened during the Zuma years, nothing. It was almost like, you know, don't look here, look over here. Everybody pay attention to what's going on my right-hand side. Don't bother to look at the left because that's going to be a disaster. If you see that, the whole illusion's going to be spoiled. That's what it was. And it was deeply, deeply disturbing, I thought. No acknowledgement of... where we're at. We've got Eskom going. I mean, just this week, we had the CEO of Eskom, and this guy is busy telling us that we need 15% for the next 3 years. So 15% increase now, another 15% increase next year, another 15% increase the year after. And no mention of any of this in the ANC's manifesto. Who put Eskom in that position? Political animals in the ANC.
But my point is, what is even scarier for me is that the ANC, which is the governing party that has all of these people that are saying this year in 2019 we're going to take them down from mm-hmm. their 66 majority, where they're going to lose them. If they come out with 59%, maybe they'll have to go into a coalition government. But nobody else is giving us an alternative. So the DA is not coming out and saying, you know what,
these are the five things that I'm going to do.
The EFF is not saying these are the five things that I'm going to do. I've been trying to, I'm racking my brain. So I remember, I think one of the first of their first manifestos, they came out with the Better Life for All. You know, that's like a rallying cry. You can believe right. in that. Then what is their one salient single-minded proposition on this?
Same old, same old.
What is the DA single-minded proposition after launching their billboard? The ANC is killing us. And so if I vote for you, and then what?
Mm-hmm.
The EFF. Well, you know what I'm saying?
EFF exists only because they were in opposition to the ANC and so, because they're kicked out.
So but they're going to join them.
I think
them
that
again.
Is the really now scary thing.
This is what Kent, now, this is an interesting point of view. Canton said for the longest time that the ANC and the EFF have been talking to each other quietly behind closed doors. They're going to come together again.
I'm very convinced of this.
When the EFF was launched, I think Rina can be a testament to this. That's what I said. I said this is only up until they can get rid of Jacob Zuma, who they have now turned to see as their enemy. And it's those top guys. It's understand that this is about keeping a job.
Mm-hmm. And the next person nice they will salary. Get rid of is Ramaphosa.
Absolutely. Oof. Absolutely. But Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't make decisions. He will be easy to get rid of.
Yes,
he doesn't make any decisions. He doesn't lead in any
Cyril
way.
Cyril Ramaphosa was chief executioner who drove Julius Malema out of the party. I don't think that Julius...
He was a figurehead.
No, he chaired the disciplinary hearing. Yeah. Yes, and he delivered the judgment against Julius Malema.
He did mm-hmm. not take the decision.
Yes, but I don't think that Julius Malema has forgiven him for that.
My point is, we keep watching a Cyril Ramaphosa, and you know the media loves to have these terms like hamstrung. It's a term. It's a big thing. But he is actually, he is not a leader. He's not a decision maker. Well, Greg, I had a very interesting conversation with a guy that knew him years ago from his days in the unions.
Yeah.
And the fact that this is a guy who's grown up in his career as a peacemaker, as a middleman. He's a person who was trying to get the unions. And so he's all about compromise. He's mm-hmm. all about compromise. That's why he doesn't make decisions. Even when Gwede, you know this, when he was scary in the union, he was this big, scary guy throwing his weight around in the union. No, if you ask the guys at Kolobeni, they also feel he's scary.
He's just big. He's got a public opinion.
But he knows how to throw his weight around. He knows how to throw his weight
We're
around.
Whereas
Matamela does not. Gareth would love that.
What a bit of fat shaming. No, okay, so hang on. We're saying a lot of things here. What I'm trying to focus us on at the moment is that this is an election year. So what you're telling me is that the choices for the average South African are so paltry that we either go with the more of the same illusion act that the ANC is trying to pull.
And hope somehow. And
pull hope out of nowhere with no justifiable reason to keep hope going. Just because they are the lesser of all the evils, maybe that's the way most people will feel about them. Then there's this this tumble down DA. Then there's this ridiculous EFF, which in any case is, according to Canton anyway, just a proxy for the ANC, or at least a useful tool for them to distract us even more from their own foibles. Who are you left with? I mean, must we rally again behind Mosiwa Lekota?
The very first election slogan for the IFP guys was "Indoda Ongayithemba, a man you can trust."
Yeah, I remember that. That was Mangosuthu Buthelezi.
He's
in his 90s now. He's in his 90s.
But
he's still the leader of that party. If we were Zimbabwe, he would be well placed to be our president for life.
So guys, the thing about it is that we as South Africans can no longer sit back. We can no longer sit back and hope to be governed by ballot. We have to be participatory. And it sounds anarchist, right? It sounds like V for Vendetta, everybody in a mask and out on the street. Mm-hmm. But actually, everybody needs to be out on the street. You need to hold your councillor accountable. You need to hold your mayor accountable. You need to hold your every single one on every level of government.
If marching, getting on the streets actually achieved anything, I'd be doing it
but
every
not
day.
Marching. That's my point. South Africans have learned to sit back.
When are you starting your political party?
Is going to do
when are you starting your political party?
Kano, what did you say it must be called?
This is an ongoing theme in the last couple of weeks of the Burning Platform, is that Canton is telling Pumi to start a party and Pumi's telling Canton to start a party.
Yes. But Canton had for it last week.
I think South Africans need to take... We can no longer sit back and hope. Hope is not a strategy. We have to act.
Oh, that is a quote. I am writing that down.
All right.
Hope is not a strategy.
So all right. What are we talking about this morning, guys, by the way?
Well, there's quite a lot on the agenda. Let's start with... let's go through a few of the things that everybody's talking about this week. I mean, we mentioned the ANC's manifesto. That's a big part of what we wanted to discuss. But let's talk about the opposition for a minute. Because the DA are on the campaign trail. Pumi just said the ANC is killing us is their slogan. They held some kind of a rally yesterday in Johannesburg.
To unveil a billboard.
Yeah, so what do you think of this? I mean, they took supporters through the unveiling of this billboard. They were talking about the victims of the Life Estimini tragedy, the Marikana massacre, obviously trying to make it look like, and you don't need to really work terribly hard to do this, the ANC really doesn't care about poor people or people who are disadvantaged at all. But the opposition party says that these lives were lost due to the ANC's dysfunctional leadership.
So, Canton, I have a question for you.
Yes.
As somebody who's watched politics for a very long time and sitting in the space of media, what does this mean about the DA's political strategy?
I don't think the political strategy is actually what matters. It's ultimately what's going to ensure that they get people to the polls. Let's remember that Tony Leon took a lot of flack back in the day when he came back with the
Fight Back
campaign. Mm-hmm. But what people forget is that Fight Back was highly successful.
And it created a very polarized South Africa that we see today.
But the world as we know it, the world as we know it today is highly polarized. And it's a pattern that's actually not going to be changing. And we're going to be going through the cycle where it's going to get extremely polarized. It'll eventually end in some sort of conflagration.
So the DA
I wanted
is divisive.
To use the word conflagration, by the way, because you used ineptitude.
So the DA is divisive.
I'm saying that
that's what they want. They want to divide us all.
Everyone is divisive right now. But what you're trying to do is to, within that division, you're trying to find particular rallying points. And it's a fact that it is the ineptitude of the ANC that led to all of those conflicts that we've had over the past period. The question that we really need to ask is whether this is going to be successful for the DA in terms of actually getting people to the polls.
Yep.
I am of the view that everyone knows for the past 10 years that the ANC is this disaster. But the fact that the DA is now pointing out that the ANC is a disaster and was responsible for all these deaths, I don't think that's actually going to inspire people to get off their butts and go and then vote for the DA instead. Because that really is the issue. Is it going to get people to the polls? And when they then get to the polls, are they going to put their cross next to the DA's name? I don't think that that's going to work.
No. I agree with you. In other words, it's a negative, reactive campaign rather than something that's positive.
Yes. And right now, there's nothing that's going to tell people...
The DA is unelectable, guys.
You need to get out of bed on election day and you need to go and put your cross next to these particular
people. And the DA is unelectable.
Why do you say they're unelectable? I mean, that's
because their morals are appalling.
Oh, God. Let's...
All right.
No, seriously.
Talk
to
me about this.
For instance, for me... To not be able to articulate what it is that you would do outside of... So we understand, everybody understands that we are here where we are, where there is constant crisis and we are floating from crisis to crisis as a South Africa, is because the ANC has led us to this point.
Right.
We all understand that. But they are unable to articulate what it is that they will do differently. They are unable to say to me.
Yeah, but that's what you said is they are unelectable because they have no morals.
No, no, no. I'm saying one of the reasons why they are unelectable is because they are also, they are divisive. So for the DA, unfortunately, with their small base of predominantly...
I hate to point this out, but when you say that they're unelectable, they are the party that has been consistently growing.
They're the only party that's grown significantly.
The EFF hasn't been tested
They
yet,
come off so. A base
no,
of zero.
No, because so, there was
so
no one
from
else
a
there.
Base of zero. No, there have been other people there, but other people have basically floundered along the way. Yeah. Look, guys,
people like Bantu and Musiwa have disappeared into the ether.
Yeah, but the DA has been growing consistently. But they're not growing quickly enough to actually enable them to ever become the party of government in at a national level.
And they've almost plateaued because they are failing. They are failing to reimagine themselves into a place where they can be a party.
I don't believe the numbers say otherwise.
I can't see myself in the DA, and the DA needs people like me.
No, but that's a different point.
So what I mean by the DA needs people like me is the DA needs young, black, professional people because that's who
but
they.
But that is where they've been growing. With respect, yes, it is.
So,
especially in the metros,
guys. Can I just put some perspective out here? Okay, in Gauteng, more black people voted for the DA than voted for the EFF. Can we just put that in perspective?
Oh.
Okay, so this whole idea about the DA actually being unelectable, no, it's not true. The numbers are very clear that the DA has been growing among young black people. But the question is whether the DA is growing at a rate that's quick enough to actually allow it to get into power before I'm dead and gone.
So the last Ipsos survey that I saw about a week ago, so just before the manifesto, was fascinating for me because it showed that the ANC... the number of people that they spoke to, the ANC would go down to about 59%, mm-hmm. right? But interestingly, the DA also goes down, and the DA loses, about 17 points. So they go down to about, they were currently sitting at 17 ahead of the last election. Mm-hmm. They go down to 12.
Yeah, but surveys fluctuate. And so surveys fluctuate on a month-by-month
thing
month
about
basis.
That, the thing about that is the fact that where people did used to see the DA at some point, so in the last election, the people did see the DA as a viable alternative.
Yes.
I think the way that the DA has, over the past couple of years, presented itself, they have... And it will be fascinating to see the kind of loss that they take in the next election.
I totally agree with you from the point of view that they have mismanaged themselves, their branding, their PR, this whole Patricia de Lille fiasco, whether they were right or wrong, it was managed badly. Musi Maimane is really milquetoast. I mean, the guy is just, he's not an inspiring leader. They should put up a poster that says, "We have blacks too." As their election campaign, because it's that insipid. It's so insipid.
You're from your mayor over there, Solim Simang.
Yeah.
Who this is going to be the premier of Gauteng.
Yeah.
You know, Solim Simang is just as insipid.
Well, he may well be, but certainly Tswane is running better than it ran under any government before. And all I want is competence. I actually don't give two shits who they are. I don't care what ethnic background they have. I don't care what struggle credentials they have. And this is, we've got to this point because we've been looking for the wrong characteristics in all of our leaders. And now the DA, in its desperate attempts, while Helen Ziller and Athol Trollope and who's the head of their federal council, all of these people have been sitting behind the scenes going, we've got to have a black leader. They've chose a guy who I would have rather had Solim Simanga, frankly, who obviously still needs to be tested. He's got all his work ahead of him. But the guy seems to me to be a genuine person. You know, Musi Maimane is not inspiring in any which way. And I might have preferred even, and I know loads of people are going to hate this, but I would have preferred Herman Mashaba.
I would have preferred Mashaba.
Yeah. What?
Mm-hmm.
Guys, Herman Mashaba.
Pumi's going to start. Pumi, we're supposed to be analyzing. This is not about personalities.
This is not about a personality.
Don't get personal about Herman.
This is not about a personality. For me, when you have a mayor, as we do here in Johannesburg.
You're going to go on the Botswanophobia now, and we're getting distracted.
Who is so concerned about petty issues of xenophobia. Instead of the big issues we have in this city, that for me to have a mayor who drives around looking and asking people for looking at people in their face and deciding you could be an undocumented foreigner. Let me see your pass. That level of small thinking is not the kind of thinking that you want for a leader at that level.
I want that too. I actually want that too, because you were talking about Zimbabwe earlier, right?
You want somebody looking around, looking at people and saying you're undocumented.
I obviously want people to be prioritizing the most important things. We've got people who are being billed badly. We've got massive things around, you know, people having access to infrastructure, and we've got a crumbling system in Johannesburg which needs to be corrected. You just have to take a drive through that CBD to see how things are. I mean, it looks like an untidy house.
You don't even have to get to the CBD, even on your way to the CBD, and all our mayor cares about.
I think that you're absolutely right to point out that this is a petty thing, but I want him to look at that too. You know, there was an unpopular man now, but at the time when Giuliani was fixing New York, and he was a very good example of a mayor, he said the broken window syndrome is what you've got to be paying attention to. The minute you see in a neighborhood there's a broken window that remains broken for more than a couple of days, there's a problem.
But that, in fact, is my problem with Mashaba. I voted for Mashaba in the municipal elections. And I voted for Mashaba on the basis that I want him to do two things, and only two things. Mm-hmm. I want him to fix the traffic lights, and I want him to fix the potholes. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't done those two things.
None of those two things.
So that's my issue right now. And has he been doing the correct thing in terms of focusing on audits and trying to find the money trail in terms of where things have been going? Yes, that is a good thing to be doing. But the potholes are still there. The traffic lights are still there. And considering that this is the New York City of Africa, the idea that we cannot keep our traffic lights running every time
it rains, this
is ridiculous. You know, he has not been able to fix it.
So you've got to start somewhere to fix a broken system.
Let me just go on a bit more. So late last year, when I was dropping off someone at the Gautrain station in Marlborough, and right next to the Gautrain station in Marlborough, there is this massive pile of trash. Right next to the Gautrain station in Marlborough, there are massive potholes. Right next to the Gautrain station in Marlborough, there's a traffic light that is consistently not working. So I tweet Herman Mashaba and say, you know, with a picture of this. And what immediately happens is the DA trolls pile into me and they say, why are you not taking responsibility for your neighborhood? Why are you not part of Arasebetseng or whatever that trash clearing rubbish office is called? And there's nothing there that actually acknowledges, guy, it's your job to be getting picket up, to be cleaning up this stuff.
And
now, just in terms of cleaning up neighborhoods, let's be very clear. In my neighborhood, we have a very active residents association. We happen to have a DA councillor. We do take part in cleanups in our neighborhood on a regular basis. We do crime watches. We do all of those things. So from the point of active citizenry, there's lots of people who are doing these things on an ongoing basis. But so Mashaba is deflecting responsibility instead of turning around and saying, yes, this is right next to the Gautrain, which is meant to be flagship.
To get back to where this discussion started, because we were talking about the DA. So who do we have? How shallow is the pool of talent in terms of who our next generation of leaders are going to be if these are the people we're talking about? And where on earth do young people look in terms of role models, in terms of people who have leadership capacities and capabilities and competencies? Where do they look in terms of opposition that can stand up and say something that isn't just rhetoric and vacuous nonsense, but is inspiring and meaningful and backed up by action? Where do they look? Who do they have to look to? Is there anyone who you two are inspired to vote for? Is there anyone who you think has even the potential in any of the parties?
Not yet.
Well, that's terrifying.
Yes.
And which is why I think where young people look is they must look within. Where young people look is they must
look
within.
You are the leader you want.
More than just you are the leader you want, right? So Nelson Mandela was not a 76-year-old man that became a president. He was at some point a young person in the ANC Youth League that felt that, for me, this is not right, and this is what I'm going to do about it. At some point, Steve Biko And that for me is what we need now is we need to get off the empathy trail. We need to get off the, oh, but you know, poor me, right? And we need to realize that this country, until we as each and individual citizen take charge of, and this is the thing, you know. So Catherine says, in my neighborhood they happen to be a DA councillor, but we are very active. We do this, and his neighborhood works. His neighborhood is working. Why? Because they can hold their councillor.
Except our potholes should get fixed.
Except, you know what I'm saying. But what you are able to do is you are able to try and hold these people accountable. That's what you do. So if the DA bots are flooded by a million Johannesburg residents, say they really have absolutely no choice.
The DA bots are vicious. They're like mosquitoes. They zoom in.
I wouldn't know. I'm not on Twitter anymore.
Gareth, they only work from 9 to 5.
But I'm so glad I don't have to deal with that shit anymore. Do yourselves a favor. Get off there as well. It's not a place to have conversations. Sia's got a story a little bit later on about how Twitter are trying to clean up conversations online, but I do want to focus us
on
some of the other big issues that are going on at the moment. We'll talk about Brexit in a minute, because I mean, poor Theresa May, the most unenviable job in the world. She's not the world's most charismatic human being, but even if she was just your aunt, you'd feel desperately sorry for her at this point. It's just an unwinnable situation for her. But let's start, before we go to her, there's someone far closer to home that we need to talk about. The commission, Dudumieni, of course, giving confidential NPA documents to Busasa. Now, this Busasa thing has been ongoing for years. But the commission of against state capture, or the commission investigating state capture, has revealed that an affidavit by the inquiry's lead investigator outlines the allegation that confidential NPA documents, I mean, these are not meant to be the kinds of things that are circulated among the ordinary citizenry, right?
But we're clear that
were handed to Busasa executives by former SAA board chair Dudumieni at a meeting in 2015. The State Capture Commission says the investigations have confirmed that former South African Airways board chair Dudumieni handed over these National Prosecuting Authority documents to Busasa executives Angelo Agrizi and Gavin Watson. Now, how this gets the president's daughter involved here, because I think she was involved in something else there as well. It's a very complicated web. We're starting to see who the main actors were in the state capture situation. And we know that, you know, it centers around the Guptas and the Zumas, obviously. But people like Dudumieni were instrumental in making all of this happen.
Mm.
And she is still not even being held to account for what she's done to SAA.
Well, the question right now is, can she be charged for leaking those NPA documents? Because, you know, we can admit that, you know, yes, this is something that shouldn't have been done, but is it something that she can be charged for? Is it a criminal offense? If it isn't, then, you know, really, guys, we should ignore it and move on and actually get to the theft of the money itself. I think we're getting, you know, bogged down right now in the minutiae of this stuff. Really, what we should be looking for is we can actually prosecute for the following things, and we should actually be prosecuting for the following things. I don't think we're at that stage yet in terms of actually drawing up charge sheets based on what's coming out of the state.
And surely these days it is easier to trace money than ever before.
Absolutely.
Right. We've got electronic signatures on every tiny cent that moves from one account to another. We must go after the money. I reckon you've got to hit...
But it starts with SARS. We've had this conversation before. Yeah. That if SARS is actually not initiating the inquiries, then we're going to have the back and forth that, like we have with the EFF and Polly van Wyk, where they, you know, he says, she says, and the only point at which we'll see who's correct is when we actually get access to the bank accounts. The EFF's not going to open up those bank accounts, and Polly's not going to reveal her sources, and we have to wait until we actually have a commissioner at SARS who's actually doing what's meant to be done.
Or even, you know, so the thing that I am fascinated about watching all of this information being revealed is we're waiting for somebody to open up a case. one of the things that the EFF is very good at is showing up at Hillbrow police station and starting a case. We don't know where those cases go. So one of the things that's the most fundamental, we're waiting for either the president, can he make these kinds of decisions to say, this has been, we've got this kind of information, the NPA needs to move into. At the NPA, we now have a new head of the NPA.
We have a new head.
And she needs to make some...
Shamila Batoi, what's she done so far?
She needs to make some tough decisions because she is in a position that can decide that we're going to investigate this further, we're going to prosecute on the information that we have ventilated in court.
Prosecution has to be on the basis of actually having a paper trail that's when you stand up in court. Because the last thing that you want now is a situation where you have a botched case. And so I'm cutting the new NPA head some slack on the basis that
she needs to get her ducks in a row.
I would rather have a situation where ducks in a row, and she's only been there for what, a month barely?
Yeah.
And is that enough to actually, firstly, you have to recognize that within the NPA, you are going to have this trail of deployees within those structures who are going to be constantly looking at undermining everything that she's going to be trying to be doing.
Right.
So she's going to have to work out a way. And so we're talking about leaking of confidential NPA documents. And how much of an issue is that going to be right now? She is sitting there and trying to come up with structures that are going to actually prosecute these cases, but you have people within the NPA who have been deployed by exactly the same people who were there under Shaun the Sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And now she has to find out a way of isolating who those people are, ensuring that they don't have access to the information. And, you know, where do you take it from there? So well, it's going to be a slow process.
It's this idea of you know, a pocket of potatoes is only as good as its most rotten potato. The NPA is full of these rotten potatoes. You can't put her in as a fresh one and expect her to pass on that freshness to all the rotten ones.
Exactly.
So she's got a lot of housekeeping to do. I understand that. And I do think it's fair to give her a little more than a month. But I think this is precisely the kind of situation where it involves NPA documents. So she can say, look, we're investigating this. We're going to lay charges. But also, Kath and Pumi.
And just the trail of how that leak.
Right.
Where does the source of this leak? She can do that.
Absolutely.
She can use it as a way to purge or to begin a purge. Put people through disciplinaries. You know, those things do happen. They've got to have... decisions have to be made.
Decisions have to be made. But more importantly, and this is something I keep going back to every time we hear about these stories in the news, everything from VBS to state capture to... every single story in South Africa, in Eskom, the parastatals, Dudumieni, where is all this money that's been stolen? We need to find this money.
Not in South Africa, I can tell you that.
Well, we need to find this money and get it back. And surely there are trails. There are ways that we can find this money. SARS, who are desperately going after legitimate, law-abiding taxpayers.
So
they're going after people who are working hard, and they're saying, we're going to tax you more. We're going to punish you for the government's theft over the last 10 years. They can find, if SARS are of a mind to do so, they can find all of the leads that they need to recover all of these stolen billions.
It's the political will. You know, we have cases where even people who have come out and accepted and acknowledged the fact that they were party to this, they were wrongfully paid McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, there is no political will to recover this money.
Well, not yet.
It's coming, I'm sure.
From where?
Because eventually we're going to end up in a situation like Zimbabwe where we don't have any money left because the people of this country, the good, hard-working people of this country, don't have any more to give.
Well, actually, they do. And, you know, as we've seen from the ANC now actually looking at all of our pension funds and saying, well, let's go after those.
Or and our health insurance.
Yes, and that is going to be an absolute bloody disaster.
Book out of the Apartheid History Museum.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So do you think that we'll get to a point where we'll have a tax revolt ever? Because the average citizen is up to here already.
Yeah, the reason why we're not unlikely to have a tax revolt in this country is because our tax gets taken away from us before we actually have the opportunity to withhold it. That's income tax. So remember that the single biggest source of income that we get for the national budget is from personal income tax, which is, and I think we're probably the only
4 million people.
Yeah, we're the only country in the world where that is the scenario, that the single biggest source of revenue comes from personal income tax, because companies have the ability to actually withhold the amount of tax that they pay, you know, through all sorts of
devious channels.
Well, not devious. I mean, I think it's our patriotic duty to avoid tax as far as possible.
Absolutely, especially when you have an immoral, corrupt government who's going to misappropriate that money.
Tax avoidance is legal. It's tax evasion that is not.
Correct.
I say again that all tax is theft. I don't believe that the state knows how to manage my money better than I do. And I don't believe that it's incumbent on anyone to give any more than they absolutely legally have to. And you've got to make sure you withhold every cent that isn't the government's from them taking it.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, I'll go with that.
That's the only moral thing to do.
Mm-hmm. No, but and you see, for me, that the biggest contributor, and almost all over the world, that's why South Africa is the only one where we get it from individuals' income tax. It's cheaper and easier to collect tax out of companies. They're bigger, they make more money, they use more of the infrastructure than the individuals.
But it's not
and so
we,
they are but it's not that more responsible not, than we
hold
are.
Hold on, Pumi, it's not that we're not getting tax out of companies.
We're not getting
We're getting the
enough.
Biggest proportion. No, companies are paying plenty of tax too. Oh, everybody pays for this useless hierarchy that we're supporting in government.
So
everyone is paying.
Have you seen the tax rate that Steinhoff was paying at the height of?
You run a company. I run a company. We have to pay tax. You know how that hurts. It doesn't hurt you any less than income tax. The difference is that in South Africa, we have this
dual.
Well, our tax base is too small. So you're still taxing the same people, whether you're taxing them by income or by company.
Well, let me tell you guys something seriously scary. I was checking out the RMB market updates yesterday, and we have a 5.6% contraction in our mining output.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, understand that something like 50% of our forex revenue, well, it's about 45%, comes from mining.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you have a 5.6% contraction in mining output, at the same time that you have a decline in the value of gold and platinum, which is where most of our revenue comes from, understand that that's a significant hit in terms of the money that's flowing into the country. And that's the kind of stuff.
And therefore, money that will flow into treasury.
Yes, and we're actually not focusing on that. We need to be actually recognizing that we're contracting in terms of the stuff that we're producing that actually has real value outside. So our economic growth is going to be shot to hell next year.
I don't think we have to wait till next year. I think in the second half of this year we're going to see it.
Therefore, if you go after individual taxpayers or you go after company tax, you're going after the same people's pockets, which I'm telling you are getting increasingly bare.
Yes.
And as a result, I mean, that's why the idea that in America, and we'll get to Brexit in a moment while we're talking international stuff, but the idea that in America there are people like Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who are saying, well, all we have to do is tax that 1% at 90%. There's still not enough. There aren't enough of the people in the 1%. That's why it's called the 1%.
Correct.
For you to be able to make enough to fill the huge gaping hole in your budget that has been eaten away by thieves. So this is where the problem lies.
So bringing us back to the whole question of, you know, who we end up voting for, the DA has not been speaking about this stuff. They're not speaking about how do you actually transform the economy and build new wealth. They are speaking about corruption, but just simply eliminating corruption now is not going to fix the problem overnight. We are sitting with a close to 3 trillion rand debt hole that we need to be filling. We are sitting with Eskom's debt, which is over and above that stuff, which someone's going to have to pay for that eventually. The whole question of how do we actually grow the economy and get to the point that we're going to be able to fix that, no one is speaking about that. And we know the answers. There are absurdities that we have in government right now that we need to get rid of. Our labor laws are the single biggest stumbling block we have to creating jobs. We need to actually turf those out completely. We know as well that our affirmative action policies are an absolute flippant disaster. If we look in terms of the scenario right now for medical schools as a very basic example, we have white kids with 9 distinctions who are not able to get into medical school just simply because they have race-based quotas, which then end up with a scenario where you have young black kids with a 70% aggregate pass rate who then get taken into medical school, who then pass medical school with a 50% pass rate. And so effectively, instead of churning out the best possible people in the country, what we are doing is pushing for a race-based lowest common denominator that we are, which is never going to allow us to actually hold our own with every other country in the world that's actually pushing a meritocracy. But the DA is not talking about this. No one is talking about this. No one is willing to turn around and say, race-based policies are bad. Transformation is a bad idea. It doesn't actually work anywhere in the world because it actually holds back the best possible people to fix stuff at any given stage.
Are you side-eyeing me with that? Is this are you trying to bait me?
No, I'm not side-eyeing it.
With this?
No, I'm not going to bait you.
How is transformation a bad idea?
We're not going to get into how is transformation a bad idea.
I need to understand it. How is transformation a bad idea?
I think this is fascinating because I think this is what
transformation is a bad idea if the criteria for transformation is color.
So transformation is not a bad idea. It is the criteria that you have a problem with.
I always used to say in terms of my hiring practices at every place where I was responsible for hiring, you know, which is pretty much where I've been working for my entire life. I would say all things else being equal, the black, disabled, Jewish, lesbian gets the job.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all things else being equal. So in other words, you push first for merit and you make sure that on the basis of merit and thereafter you look at selection.
So how
but,
do you
but
allow?
Nobody's talking about that. But let's not get sidetracked.
No,
we'll have a separate discussion about transformation.
I need to understand
but
it
let's,
further.
Let's
because
just focus
so the
on
problem is, so I need to understand this because what I'm hearing you say now is that your problem is not transformation. Your problem are the current criteria around how transformation is being put on the table. Is that what you're saying?
I've said what I've said.
Yeah, so
I think
I'm not going to be drawn into the transformation discussion further. What I am saying is that no one is talking about it.
And it's a big elephant in the room.
No one is talking about
because
it.
Because our ability to deliver, our efficiency and our competence is dropping, and we've got to address the reasons for that. And if transformation is being applied incorrectly, and that's part of the reason that we're inefficient, and that the country has been in stasis for the last 10 years, then we need to address that too. Because it's not just administration. It's not just political appointments and state capture and all of that stuff. In businesses, we're seeing a stasis at the moment. There isn't growth to the tune that we would like. And the only place that there is growth is the one place where government doesn't interfere, and that's in small businesses. Or where those businesses are so small that they run by their own rules effectively, within obviously the framework of our very onerous labor laws, but where those companies are able to do what they need to do nimbly in order to survive, let alone thrive. And in order to give opportunities to talented young black people who might have been left out of that situation before.
It's much
harder in big corporations because everything is so super regulated now that it's made it impossible to move.
I think one of the things that we are all failing to do, which small business is still able to with quite a lot of agility, mm-hmm. is reimagine. So reimagine where the opportunities for growth and making money are. Because even as people have got to live,
yeah.
people are living, people are striving to get from a day to day. And it is in reimagining the way that we see our businesses and see our services and see the things that from all the way from individuals to small businesses
Absolutely.
To big businesses and to government as a whole. We've got to reimagine and change our focus and change our gaze, as it were, from a particular point of view into one where we can reimagine a new way of working, a new way
Absolutely.
Of governing,
and
a new
best,
way of
and
being.
And the best environment for that kind of reimagining and the best environment for a flourishing small business is one with the least possible amount of government in it, I'm afraid. And that's precisely where we'll leave that point, because I do want to get to Brexit. We've been talking about this. Tuesday, they voted. Theresa May's proposition for a Brexit deal was completely and overwhelmingly outvoted. But then yesterday, Labour's attempt to unseat her in a motion of no confidence was also a disaster for them. So she stays, but Brexit is still very much on the cards, except we don't know how it's going to happen.
Well, we do know how it's going to happen. Because
how?
We have the World Trade Organization rules that actually govern how you do trade between countries. And that's a very well-defined framework. So on the assumption right now...
So is this a big storm in a teacup?
It is a storm in a teacup. Yeah, yesterday.
Because the people, the Remainers are saying, oh, you see, we told you Brexit would be a disaster.
They're all a bunch of idiots. The single signifier for me, what happened immediately at the point at which she lost the vote? The pound appreciated.
Good point.
The pound went up drastically. And, you know, all of the financial commentators who go on about the fact that, oh, look, this is a disaster, we told you so, and all of this kind of stuff, the markets reacted in the appropriate way. They said, great, this deal that Theresa May was trying to craft was a disaster from the get-go, because what she was trying to do was to actually effectively keep the UK within the EU without it being called part of the EU.
So in other words, it was like a hoax.
Yes. Let's remember that the Conservatives, under David Cameron, when they called for the referendum in the first place, they said so up front that they think it's a bad idea to leave the EU, but they're going to put it out to the public in any way. And they lost it. But the Conservatives still believe that being part of the EU is a good thing. Labour now is aware that they can't be supporting Remain because they will lose that. It's hugely unpopular. The reason why, and you know, everyone keeps talking about we need to go for a people's vote.
Mm-hmm.
Let's understand that the number of people who turned out to vote for Brexit
more than in any general election.
More than in any general election. And what's very clear is that if they were to run the referendum again, they would turn out in even bigger numbers and vote to leave again.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I'm clear that Nigel Farage is betting on that pound left, right, and center. I'm sure he's laughing all the way to the bank. This kind of turmoil.
I don't think Nigel Farage is smart enough to actually do that kind of stuff. but you know, the fact is that the markets actually are going to determine what happens. I tweeted a piece that I wrote in 2016 yesterday.
It was a
fairly comprehensive breakdown of every sector of the British economy and what the impact is likely to be in the event of Brexit. I think that Brexit is a good thing for the UK, irrespective of all of the emotional stuff that people get caught up with.
So why are people so emotional about this? Because if you say it's just a market decision, but why are people emotional about this? What is the thing that the people who are such ardent Remain supporters, what is the thing they're scared of losing?
We like this idea of a globalized world where we are all touchy-feely and, you know, we all love each other and we can move freely across borders. And, you know, I'd love that too, but you need to have a commonality of values if you're getting to the point where that's happening. And the single biggest thing that we need to take a look at is if we pop up a map of Europe right now, and let's say you just color in the countries where there's rampant unemployment, and then color in the countries where there's economic growth and employment. And you have these massive holes in Greece, you have these massive hole in Italy, you have this massive hole in Spain, and then Germany, you know, lights up and is looking good, and France is looking sort of halfway close to Germany, but the UK is looking good. The UK is still a place where people flock to for employment and all of that kind of stuff. And you have a situation in the UK where they are fully aware of the fact that you're getting people who are flocking from poorer countries in the rest of Europe, and they're effectively ending up taking jobs that people in the UK feel actually should be theirs.
It's identity politics, and people are emotional about who they think they are.
It's not identity politics. It's actually a question of being nationalistic, which is very different. Identity politics and nationalism is really very different.
Do you think?
Here's the other interesting thing that people don't speak about with regard to Brexit. Because remember that you've had entire generations of people who are migrants who've been raised in the UK. So you have a very strong migrant community from the Caribbean. Uh-huh. You have a very strong migrant community from
Pakistan,
the Indian subcontinent.
Largest population outside of India.
No, that's in South Africa.
It's second in South Africa.
But the problem that they've got right now is that following the UK entry into the EU, it means that their ability to then get their family from their countries to then migrate to the UK has been removed. So there's a very strong incentive on their part. I'm talking about the first generation migrant community, in order for their friends and family to be eligible for migration to the UK, it's going to be better for them if they are outside of the EU, because then they are not bound by the EU migration rules.
Hmm. So, in other words, you're saying that it's not as it's not as simple and as black and white as that this is a bunch of nationalist, old school, conservative British people.
Exactly.
It's also second and first generation migrants who still have connections to their own people outside of the UK and might want to bring them in.
And they're a significant chunk of people. Yes.
And also, of course, those are the people who decided to come to Britain.
Yes, for they're the probably, right reasons.
They're probably more nationalistic than people would like to believe as well.
Yes.
They believe themselves it's not like Mugabe.
It's for good reason that chicken tikka is the most popular dish in the UK.
That's a very good point. That's true. Try and find boring old bangers and mash. It's not as easy as you think in London. All right. You too, thanks for handling things this morning in the Burning Platform. Sia, thanks for putting it all together. Pumi Mashiho, I just have to compliment you on the amazing breakfast that you made for your son, which you posted on Twitter this morning. She made, French toast?
Wait. Gareth, you said you're not on Twitter. What's going on here?
It's egg in the hole.
You know what? I had to go on because you told me that you'd written an article, so I'm going to go and read your article. No, that's the reason I went on.
All right.
And upon going onto Twitter, because I only follow a few people now, it's like 200 people that I follow, and most of them are quiet, as you two are a lot of the time on Twitter. But when they do post things, then it comes up straight away, and Pumi's tweet came up immediately. You said it's what is that you made?
I
scrambled eggs.
It's not scrambled eggs.
What is
it's
that?
Because I in a former British colony grew up here in a former British colony. It's egg in a hole.
Oh, look at you!
A very British breakfast.
Very nice. Well, you see, some mums, even if they're very busy, even if they get here on time at 6 a.m, still able to provide their sons with a loving meal to start their day, and the most important
and a
meal
glass of
the
milk, yeah, but
and
yeah,
a glass of milk,
not fizzy drinks.
I like this a lot. Thank you, Pumi Mashiho. Thank you, Kanthan Pillay. That is the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. Today, we will return next week Thursday with some more. There's always lots to talk about. We really did run the gamut today, from the DA to Brexit to Cyril's boring manifesto to Eskom to
I'm exhausted. I may need to go to
drunken
bed.
Drunken pedestrians.
Yes, I thought that was a very interesting point. Just before I walked into the studio, they were talking quite a lot about South Africans on the road and road death toll, which Bladen Zimande was addressing at a conference yesterday. And Kanthan made the point that most of the deaths on South African roads are drunken pedestrians.
Even not drunken pedestrians. A couple of days ago, a very luminous member of our athletics team here, Team South Africa, who's a 4-kilometer runner, represents South Africa in All Africa Games, in the Commonwealth Games, and he's actually won some medals. Was knocked down and died on his way walking home from practice.
Mm. Yeah. I think this
is. So it's not just the drunk ones.
It's not just the drunk ones, but then in that case, if he was knocked down, that was a driver. But we've got to take, and it's never really raised as a big issue by whoever's the transport minister or the transport authorities or the guys who are running ARTO now, which is going to be this draconian system where we get demerit points if we go onto the yellow line and. You know, 5 points come off here, and if you didn't renew your license within a month, 10 points come off here, and all of these rules.
25% of all our accidents involve minibus taxis.
Well, we don't ever address that either. Yes. Why?
Because because ANC members own minibus taxis and they have money from it.
And because they're afraid of the taxi owners if they don't form part of the ANC.
He said what he said.
Yeah, there's an interesting point. Think about it. Why are these things never addressed? Why is it always easy to go for the law-abiding people?
I thought people thought that it was IFP people who drove, big Zulu men who drove taxis. Now you're telling me they're actually ANC.
Oh, just one other little bit of feedback. The David Bowie song didn't work for me. Oh my God, it was horrible. Pumi's African pride, fine. That one was all right, but yo. I mean, I love David Bowie more than anybody, but that song was awful. All right, thank you, everybody.
Oh, goodness.
That's a wrap on today's Burning Platform, and we will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Coming up,
the DJ, I'm the rap.
A conversation that I had with Rams Mabote not so long ago. That's coming up next for your listening pleasure, and plenty of good stuff this morning on cliffcentral.com, including Stoodla, Mafetle Fetle, Alan Ford with his show, The Unview. No doubt this morning, a great show, as Alan always says. A great show. And he's going to be regaling us with all kinds of stories from South Africa's entertainment business, the theatre, the musicals, the plays, the big events. You know how it goes with Alan. We will see you tomorrow at 6 o'clock, bright and early. Thank you for joining us today.
This is CliffCentral.com.